You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9 with Marco and Sugar. Hello, welcome. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. That was Sugar and What's Up Star, of course. I always talk about stars. So what's happening in astronomy? We're going back to the moon. President Trump and NASA and I think Vice President Pence said we're going forward to the moon again, probably within 5 years. So who's we? Maybe not Canada, but the U.S. is. So here's the NASA Administrator's statement on the return to the moon. NASA Administrator Ian Bridenstine released a statement on Tuesday, announcement by Vice President Mike Pence at the fifth meeting of the National Space Council about putting American astronauts back on the moon in the next 5 years. And quote, "It is the right time for this challenge, and I assure the Vice President that we, the people of NASA, are up to the challenge." And here it says, read the full text. Do we want to? No, I don't think so. It just basically, among the topics discussed during the meeting are NASA is charged to get American astronauts to the moon in the next 5 years. We are tasked with landing on the moon's south pole by 2024. Let me think, what's the significance of the south pole? Maybe that's where some of the craters in the water is. Stay on schedule for flying Exploration Mission 1 with Orion on the Space Launch System rocket next year, and for searching the first crewed mission to the lunar vicinity by 2022. NASA will continue to use all means necessary to ensure mission success in moving us forward to the moon. So, Vice President Mike Pence said it's the right time. So they're going back to the moon, and I think they've been talking about it for a while. And, of course, it's going to be by 2030. They always say 2022. It's probably not 2022. They say within 5 years, we'll see. Okay, so they're going back to the moon, and I think it's part of it is called the Gateway Project, where they have a system or a base, an outer space base, not on the moon. Maybe one's going to be on the moon, but one's going to be orbiting the moon, and there's going to be astronauts coming and going. So we'll see what happens. Okay, so last week I talked a lot about the moon. So the moon is our buddy. It does a lot of good things for us. And without it, our poles would tilt even more. So, for example, now, I think last week was the spring equinox, where the sun is bang on to the equator. Now the Earth starts to tilt, and we'll get summer because of the tilt. And the North Pole will have 24 hours of daylight for a while. So if the moon wasn't there to stabilize us, it's possible our North Pole could go all the way down to the equator, and then in the winter it would come back up north. So that would be quite a tilt. Melt all the polar ice caps. I don't know if we would survive. So the moon does all this stabilization. So it's our buddy. Now, there was something here that I thought was very interesting, and it's something I've been following for a lot of years. In 1977, there was a launch of two Voyager spacecraft, and there was an alignment of the outer gas giants, where it would be easier because they're closer to each other, and because due to gravity assists from the planet. So, for example, a spacecraft could visit Jupiter and then fly past Jupiter and close enough so Jupiter would fling it out at a faster rate, a gravity assist in its trajectory, and it would send it out to Saturn. And the same could be done at Saturn and so on. So the Voyager spacecraft did that. And now they're in interstellar space. I think both of them are interstellar space. So I'm going to read an article about the Voyagers. It's something I've been following for a long time. So the article is on www.nasa.gov, and it's March 27, 2019. and it's titled The Voyage to Interstellar Space, and it shows a magnetometer on a photo here, on an illustration of NASA's Voyager spacecraft with the magnetometer, MAG instrument, and its boom displayed. Okay, so I'm going to read this article now. Again, March 27, NASA.gov, The Voyage to Interstellar Space. By all means, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 shouldn't even be here. Now in interstellar space, they are pushing the limits of spacecraft and exploration, journeying through the cosmic neighborhood, giving us our first direct look into the space beyond our star. But beyond our solar system, I think it should have said that. Not beyond our star, beyond our solar system. Oh yeah, beyond our star, yeah. The star, yeah, our sun is the solar system, okay. But when they launched in 1977, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 had a different mission, to explore the outer solar system and gather observations directly at the source from outer planets we had only seen with remote studies. But now, four decades after launch, they've journeyed farther than any other spacecraft from Earth into the cold, quiet world of interstellar space. Originally designed to measure the property of the gas of the giant planets, the instruments on both spacecraft have spent the past few decades painting a picture of the propagation of solar events from our sun. And the Voyager's new mission focuses not only on the effects on space from within our heliosphere, the giant bubble around the sun filmed up by the constant outflow of the solar particles called the solar wind, but from outside of it too. Though they once helped us look closer at the planets and their relationships to the sun, they now give us clues about the nature of interstellar space as the spacecraft continue their journey. So a few years ago, Voyager 1 left our solar system, and I believe Voyager 2 has too. So let's read on, see if that's true. The environment they explore is colder, subtler, and more tenuous than ever before. And yet the Voyagers continue on, exploring and measuring the interstellar medium, a smorgasbord of gas, plasma, and particles from stars and gas regions, not originating from our system. Three of the spacecraft's 10 instruments are the major players that study how space inside the heliosphere differs from interstellar space. Looking at this data together allows scientists to piece together our best yet picture of the edge of the heliosphere and the interstellar medium. Here are the stories they tell. Well, what I think about the interstellar medium, I think it's almost like a perfect vacuum, much more perfect vacuum than we could ever get on Earth. So let's read on and see what they're telling us about interstellar space, the space beyond our heliosphere. On the sunspot, we have explored, on the sunspot, we have been exploring the various instruments on Voyager 2 one at a time and analyzing how scientists read the individual sets of data sent to Earth from the far-reaching spacecraft. But one instrument we have not yet talked about is Voyager 2's magnetometer, or MAG for short. During the Voyager's first planetary mission, the MAG was designed to investigate the magnetospheres of planets and their moons, determining the physical mechanics and processes of the interactions of those magnetic fields and the solar wind. After that mission ended, the Voyager spacecraft studied the magnetic field of the heliosphere and beyond, observing the magnetic reach of the sun and the changes that occur within that reach during solar activity. Getting the magnetic data as we travel further into space requires an interesting trick. Voyager spins itself around in a calibration maneuver that allows Voyager to differentiate between the spacecraft's own magnetic field that goes along for the rise as it spins and the magnetic fields of the space it's traveling through. The initial peek into the magnetic field beyond the sun's influence happened when Voyager 1 crossed the heliopause in 2012. Scientists saw that within the heliosphere, the strength of the magnetic field was quite variable, changing and jumping as Voyager 1 moved through the heliosphere. These changes are due to solar activity. But once Voyager 1 crossed into interstellar space, that variability was silenced. Although the strength of the field was similar to what it was inside the heliosphere, it no longer had a variability associated with the sun's outburst. So it says here that the magnetic field of the sun was variable inside our solar system, And once it crossed into interstellar space, it wasn't variable anymore. So it says here that the variability inside the heliosphere, or the sun's atmosphere, was affected by the sun's outbursts, so outbursts of the suns. Okay, so now here it has a nice little neat graph. It says magnetometer, MAG data, taken from Voyager 1 during its transition into interstellar space in 2012. Okay, so it shows that the B field in nanoteslas was variable from 0.2 nanoteslas to 0.6. And then as soon as it crossed into interstellar space, the magnetic field wasn't a total straight line, but almost linear at about 0.6 nanoteslas. So it shows the interstellar magnetic field is constant, and inside the sun's atmosphere, the magnetic field varies. So what does that tell us? I don't know. It just tells us inside the sun's atmosphere, the magnetic field varies. Okay, so what does this all mean? We'll read on and see. The graph shows the magnitude or the strength of the magnetic field around the heliopause from January 2012 out to May 2014, before encountering the heliopause, marked by the orange line. So there's an orange line here. The magnetic field strength fluctuates quite a bit after a bumpy ride through the heliopause in 2012. So it shows the heliopause is not just a thin little slice. It looks like it's got some substance. It's got some width or depth or whatever. And after they crossed, this heliopause, the magnetic strength stops fluctuating and begins to stabilize in 2013, once the spacecraft is far enough out into the interstellar medium. So as soon as it hits the heliopause, it goes up a bit and it fluctuates tiny bits, but not a lot. And then once it gets out of the heliopause, it's almost totally constant. Wow, great. Let's see what this all means. In November 2018, Voyager 2 also crossed the heliopause and similarly experienced quite the bumpy ride out to the heliopause. Scientists are excited to see how its journey differs from its twin spacecraft. Scientists are still working through the MAG data from Voyager 2 and are excited to see how Voyager 2 journey differed from Voyager 1. So I think Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 launched roughly similar times. And I think what happened was that Voyager 1, after maybe Pluto, no, after after Jupiter and Saturn, I think it just shot straight out towards the interstellar medium. And Voyager 2, what it did, I think it stopped at Uranus and Neptune, or one of the two, or maybe both of them. So it took a bit of a longer path because it did some exploration. So now what I should do, you know what I think I'm going to do? I'm going to go for an ad or a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about what happened to the spacecraft when they went out into interstellar space. Thank you for listening. This is Marco. You are listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
I was a prisoner.
Cocaine addiction.
Cocaine took my dream. It made me lie, steal.
Cocaine took my will, my soul.
And all I wanted was more cocaine. Cocaine Anonymous gave me freedom and saved my life. If you got a problem with cocaine, pick up the phone. We're here to help.
Contact Cocaine Anonymous toll-free by calling 866-662-8300 or find them online at ca-bc.ca.
That's right. When Super Giant Pizza. Give me pizza!
It's been said that people disappoint, but pizza is eternal. That adage is being put to the test with Canadians weighing in on pizza, love, and slice etiquette. 6 in 10 Canadians have some type of relationship deal breaker when it comes to pizza, but 1 in 3 have no pizza love limits at all. The top deal breaker was eating pizza in bed at 18%, and closely behind was anchovies on pizza at 17%. Next up were picks the cheese off at 10%, eats pizza with a knife and fork at 8%, uses too much garlic dipping sauce at 7%, puts pineapple on pizza at 6%, doesn't eat the crust at 6%, and eats it cold at 4%. So cuddle up on the couch and share some za and some love.
Cut your life in a half like wood meat and hope she feel no I'm in a soft. Me a real done, got up. Me like your like grab up.
Look how you make me feel. Look how you make me get aggressive. Look how you make me feel. Look how you make me get sensitive. Look how you make me feel. Look how you make me get aggressive. Look how you make me feel. Look how you make me get sensitive.
You're back on Astro Talk. Marco and Stefflon Don on CITR 101.9.
Let's do some quick yes or no questions. Are the following things technically possible? Life on other planets, is that theoretically possible?
Yes.
Okay. What about a Schwarzschild wormhole?
Yes.
Okay, what about this? Me going on a date with Charlize Theron?
No.
What, not at all? In no universe?
No.
In none of the infinite universes does that happen?
No.
It's completely beyond the bounds of scientific possibility, is what you're saying?
Yes.
Quick follow-up question. In any of those potential universes, am I the one rejecting her and that's why it doesn't work out?
No. That typing your response is difficult for me, correct?
Okay, sure, yeah, it's just I'm trying to play this out because it just I'm just trying to see if there was any hypothetical hope.
No.
It doesn't matter. But never say never. Okay, if time travel were possible, would you want to go back in time and refuse to do this interview?
Yes.
You truly are an incredibly smart man. Stephen Hawking, thank you so much for your time.
Welcome back. We're back on Astro Talk talking about the Voyager missions. I don't know how many people have been following them. I sure have. And I wonder if Voyager will discover if anybody out there in the solar system, other planet or other, if it keeps going for hundreds and hundreds of thousands, if they have pizzas in other planetary systems. I wonder. Okay, I had a nice beef and onion pizza yesterday. Something I used to have when I was here at UBC. Okay, so we'll talk about more about the Voyager. So remember, the Voyagers were two spacecraft. They left Earth about later part of 1977 for a grand tour of the outer gas giants, which were in a alignment that was rare every couple hundred years or something like that happens. So Voyager 1 visited, I believe, Jupiter and Saturn, and then it went out towards the outer solar system. The outer reaches of the solar system, and I believe it crossed interstellar space. I started to cross interstellar space in 2012. And one thing that I'm so impressed by is scientists, of course, nobody's ever been there. Hard to see what's out there. All their theories and their models, when they tested out, most of it was true. I think all of it was true. It's quite amazing that a region that is so far away from us and their models worked out. Wow. So anyway, Voyager 1 left interstellar space, and it took about, 6 months or a year to cross the heliopause or the heliosheath or whatever it's called, and all of a sudden it was in interstellar space. And then when it was out there, the magnetic field was pretty stable, where inside our solar system, the magnetic field varies due to the solar wind. So the strength of the magnetic field fluctuates. So what they're doing now, they're studying data. In 2018, I believe in the latter part, Voyager 2 started to cross the heliopause or whatever it's called, and now it is out there, or going to be out there soon. So this is an article on www.nasa.gov, dated March 27, 2019, The Voyage to Interstellar Space. Now, we talked about the magnetometer, or MAG system, on Voyager. On the Voyagers, now we're going to talk about the cosmic ray subsystem. So what I do believe is to conserve fuel, and I believe the power output or the would be equivalent to about 20 or 21 watts, like a refrigerator light bulb. That's how much power the Voyagers send out now, or they have, or something like that. And when they send their signal back to Earth, I think the deep space network has to work pretty hard to receive it. And it's obviously a weak, feeble signal. It takes a long time to come back here. It's quite amazing that they can still do that. But they were running out of power. I think just like the Cassini mission, the spacecraft, its fuel ran out. So basically they are working on, they believe, shut down quite a few systems, but a few systems are still working. So one is the magnetometer, and one is, I believe it's the magnetometer, and one is the cosmic ray subsystem. So the cosmic ray subsystem is on the spacecraft behind the antenna. If you look on the article again, it's The Voyage to Interstellar Space, March 27, 2019, and it says the cosmic ray subsystem, and has an illustration here, and it says, illustration of NASA's Voyager spacecraft with the cosmic ray subsystem, CRS, highlighted. So what does the cosmic ray subsystem do? Well, I'm eager to find out. There's a couple of graphs here, so we'll all try to make sense of it here. Okay. Here it goes. Much like the MAG, or the magnetometer, the cosmic ray subsystem, called CRS, was originally designed to measure planetary systems. I didn't know that. The CRS focused on the compositions of energetic particles in the magnetospheres, or the magnetospheres, of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Scientists used it to study the charged particles within the solar system and their distribution between the planets. Since it passed the planets, however, the cosmic ray subsystem, or CRS, has been studying the heliosphere's charged particles, and now the particles in the interstellar medium. The CRS measures the count rate, or how many particles detected per second. It does this by using two telescopes, the high-energy telescope, which measures high-energy particles that have an energy of 70 million electron volt. So this is the high-energy telescope, measures high-energy particles of 70 million electron volts, or mega, identifiable as interstellar particles, and the low-energy particles, which measures low-energy telescope, which measures low-energy particles of 5 million electron volts that originate from our sun. So it had two telescopes, the high-energy telescope measuring high-energy particles of 70 million electron volts from interstellar space, and low-energy telescope, which measures low-energy particles of 5 million electron volts that originate from our sun. You can think of these particles like a bowling ball hitting a bowling pin versus a bullet hitting the same pin. Both will make a measurable impact on the detector, but they're moving at vastly different speeds. By measuring the amounts of the two kinds of particles, Voyager can provide a sense of the space environment it's traveling through. So one of them, high-energy particles, maybe it's the bowling ball hitting the pins, and the low-energy particles, maybe it's the bullet hitting the pins. I'm not sure. We'll see. Okay, so now there's two graphs here that measure something, and it is scientists compared data from Voyager 1 with its 2012 crossing of the heliopause to watch for clues for when Voyager 2 would cross. In November 2018, the first clues came from the cosmic ray subsystem. So what happens is some kind of, let me see if I can decipher it. I just hit the computer and it jumped, the page jumped. Okay, so it shows the rate of counts per second of high energy particles, and it shows that in Voyager 1, the particles, this is a weird graph. So, Voyager 2 at the heliopause. it shows the count. So there's two, and one of the graph goes down and one of the graph goes up. But what it shows is there's a definite change in the amount of particles that hit the telescopes when the heliopause is crossed. Okay, so that's the important thing. Scientists compared data from Voyager 1 with Voyager 2 to watch when Voyager 2 would cross. In November 18, the graphs started to look the same. These graphs show the count rate, how many particles per second are interacting with the cosmic ray telescope. On average each day of the galactic ray particles measured by the high energy. Oh, so the top graph is the high energy particles and the heliosphere particles measured by the low energy telescope bottom graph. Okay, so there's two graphs. So one is the top graph shows when the Voyagers cross the heliopause, the amount of particles hitting the high energy telescope increases. And that makes sense because there's probably more high energy particles out there in interstellar space. And the low energy telescope shows there's a fairly constant rate of the number of particles hitting the telescope. And when it crosses the heliopause, bang, the amount goes down. So the low energy particles go down. So that makes sense. Okay, so now I can see what the graphs mean. CRS data from Voyager 2 on November 5, 2018 showed the interstellar particle count rate of the hydrogen energy telescope increasing to count rates similar to that of Voyager 1. Similarly, the low energy telescope saw a decrease in heliosphere originating particles. This was a key indication that Voyager 2 had moved into interstellar space. Scientists can keep watching these counts to see if the composition of interstellar space particles changes along the journey. Okay, so what it shows is when both Voyagers cross the line of between the boundary between the sun and interstellar space, the amount of high energy particles increase. So it shows there's more high energy particles outside cosmic rays outside of the sun's atmosphere. So I guess the sun's atmosphere blocks some of them coming in. And it showed that inside the sun's atmosphere, before it reached the heliopause, there's a lot of low-energy particles hitting the cosmic ray telescope. And when it crosses, that goes down, and then there's very little. So it shows inside there's a lot of low-energy particles inside our solar system and not many high-energy particles. And when they cross, the high-energy particles, there's a lot of them all of a sudden, and there's a lot less low-energy particles. So what happened is the data from both these spacecraft were pretty similar. So scientists are happy about that, and they're going to keep an eye on it. Okay, ooh. Now we're going to go to another instrument. It's called the Plasma Science Instrument, or PSL. Was made to measure plasma and ionized particles around the outer planets and to measure the solar wind's influences on those planets. The Plasma Science Instrument is made up of four Faraday cups, an instrument that measures the plasma as it passes through the cups and calculate the plasma speed, direction, and density. Okay, so when they made their predictions, they said this is going to happen and that's going to happen, and it did happen. So, that's a lot to take in. So let's go to another break, and when we do, after we do, we'll come back and we'll talk more about astronomy. I'll try to finish up this article. It's quite long. But when we come back, we'll be talking more about my favorite topic, astronomy. So thank you for listening. This is Marco. You are listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
Say me wine up the ting till it pile up. Big bumper girl just a wine and a while up. They must spoil me a stock till it pile up. My money no, so it my
you
money
dance like you mean it. Dance like you on fire and you want me to know. You move like you mean it, shawty. See the look on your face. You either wanna fight or wanna make love, maybe both. Looking at you, looking at you, watching the way you wind it and pop it. One more time, go wind and pop it. Yeah, yeah. Bumper that drink got me feeling alright. Pretty little thing, I could watch it all night. Feel up on that bumper, girl, I just might. Feel up on that bumper, girl, I just might. Baby, push back when I jump behind it. When I jump behind it. So when I jump behind it, push back on me. So baby, push back when I jump behind it. Baby, let me know you like it tonight.
You're listening to Mayo on CITR 101.9 on Marco's AstroTalk. Push back.
The bar, couple shots, no chasing. My booty amazing. Come on, baby, chase it. Back to the floor, give us space. And
looking at me, watching the way I wanted him pop it. One more time, I wanted him pop it. Yeah, baby, that drink got me feeling alright. Pretty little thing, you could watch me all night. Pull up on this bomba, boy, I don't mind. Pull up on this bomba.
Hey, what are you doing? You're procrastinating. What are you doing tonight? Netflix? Again? Looking to socialize? We got you. Looking for variety? We have that. Hong Kong Student Association. Your ticket in. We're more than just a club. Come find your home. HKSA. Get involved at www.hksaubc.com.
Don't you put it in your mouth.
Don't you put it in your mouth.
Don't you stuff it in your face.
Don't stuff it in your face.
Though it might look good to eat.
Though it might look good to eat.
And it might look good to taste.
And it might look good to taste.
You could get sick.
Ick.
Real quick.
Ick.
Real sick. Real.
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Don't put it in your mouth. Put it in your ear.
Ick! Don't you put it in your mouth.
Uh-uh.
Till you ask someone you love.
That's right, sis.
If it's okay to eat.
If it's okay to eat.
Like a muffin.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. Well, that was interesting. CITR, put it in your ear. Well, of course, we all do that. Okay, so one last quick thing about this Voyager thing. Now they measured the amount of plasma coming out from the sun, and the plasma instrument on Voyager 1 was damaged on a flyby by Saturn, and it had to be shut off so it couldn't measure the interstellar medium's plasma property. Voyager 2, with the Voyager 2 crossing, scientists will get the first ever plasma measurements of the interstellar medium. I wonder how that was damaged. What happened? Did something come and hit it? A piece of rock? A piece of ice? I don't know what happened. Interesting. Okay, scientists predicted that interstellar plasma measured by Voyager 2 would be higher in density but lower in temperature and speed than plasma inside the heliosphere. And in November 2018, the instrument saw just that for the first time. This suggests that the plasma in this region is getting colder and slower, and like cars slowing down on a freeway, is beginning to pile up around the heliopause and into the interstellar medium. So the plasma from the sun piles up and doesn't go, or does it go into the interstellar medium? Let's see. And now, thanks to Voyager 2 plasma science instrument, we have a never-before-seen perspective on our heliopause, the plasma velocity from Earth to the heliopause. So what it shows is the plasma velocity. What does it show? It shows scientists now have a new view of the solar wind and plasma across the heliopause. So these three graphs tell an amazing story, summarizing a journey of 42 years. The top section of the graph shows the plasma velocity, how fast the plasma crossing the heliosphere is moving against the distance out from Earth. The distance is in astronomical units. The heliopause crossed at happened at 120 astronomical units when the velocity of the plasma coming out from the sun drops to zero, and seen in the increase in the bottom of two graphs, which show that the upward and downward spreads and the sideways speed of the solar wind of the solar plasma respectively. This means as a solar wind begins to interact with the interstellar medium, it is pushed out in a way like the wave hitting like the side of the cliff. So looking at each instrument, however, does not tell the full story. Together, these instruments tell a story about the turbulence, the transition from the turbulent active space within our sun's influence to the relatively calm waters on the edge of interstellar space. So we had three readings. The MAG shows the magnetic field strength decreases sharply in the interstellar medium. The CRS data shows an increase in interstellar cosmic rays outside, and a decrease of heliospheric particles outside in the interstellar medium. And finally, the plasma instrument shows that there's no longer any detectable solar wind outside of our heliopause in interstellar medium. Now that the Voyagers are outside of the heliosphere, their new perspective will provide new information about the formation and state of our sun and how it interacts with interstellar space, along with insight into how other stars interact with interstellar medium. Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are providing our first look at the space we would have to pass through if humanity ever were to travel beyond our home star, a glimpse of our neighborhood in space. Well, that was a long article, but very interesting. So it shows how the atmosphere, plasma, magnetic particles, in high energy particles, how everything changes once you cross the heliopause. So that, when is that going to happen? When is a human being going to cross out there? 50 years? Well, we'll see. Okay, so actually that was quite a long article. And I think what I'm going to do, I'm going to go for a quick break now, because what will happen is when I come back, I am going to be talking about a brand new topic. So that was about one of my favorite topics about crossing interstellar space. So thank you for listening. I'm going to go for a quick break. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. This is Marco, and you're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9 with Nelly and Kelly Rowland. The St. Louis thing with Nelly on CITR 101.9's Astro Talk. Welcome back. This is Marco. After listening to Nelly, you are back on Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. So we talked a lot about interstellar space, and it's something that is kind of beyond most of us because we're not going to get there anytime soon. And so it was interesting nonetheless for me to talk about it because I think it's one topic I've been following for a long, long time. So anyway, we're back now. I'm going to hit a new topic, but first I'm going to talk about the other day I was seeing there was the moon out there, a nice bright moon, and then there was a planet somewhere there. I think it's probably Saturn. I tried to look at it in my binoculars the other night. I think it looked like Saturn, but it's hard to pick out Saturn with your binoculars. It's just not big enough in your binoculars. So again, I didn't want to take out my telescopes. It's a pain in the ass, and sorry, I shouldn't have said that word, but it is difficult sometimes if you got a telescope mounted somewhere, you just go to it, point it, and bang. But I got to assemble it, take out the legs, and find some place to put it. It's just a hassle. But it would have been nice to see it. So anyway, so Saturn is hanging around, I think, and it's quite beautiful, as is the moon. You can look at the moon. It's a lovely thing. So now it's getting smaller, slice by slice, getting smaller. And what am I going to talk about next? Space butterflies. So what's a space butterfly? Okay, now we're talking about the Spitzer Space Telescope. Sometimes I'm not sure why they call it a telescope and why they would call something, I hope it's a space telescope. Yeah, it's a space telescope. Why they call it an observatory. So sometimes they call something an observatory. Sometimes they call it a telescope. And I'm not sure why. Maybe an observatory is bigger and it's got more functions and features. But anyway, we're talking about the Spitzer Space Telescope, and it says space butterflies home to hundreds of baby stars. It's got an illustration, or actually a photo here, officially known as W40. This red butterfly in space is a nebula, or a giant cloud of gas and dust. The wings of the butterfly are giant bubbles of gas being blown from inside out by massive stars. So you can go to www.nasa.gov. This is March 27, 2019. And under the Spitzer Space Telescope thing. And the title of the article is Space Butterfly is Home to Hundreds of Baby Stars. So let's look at this. What looks like a red butterfly in space is in reality a nursery for hundreds of baby stars, revealed in this infrared image from NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope. Officially named Westerhout 40, or W40, the butterfly is a nebula, a giant cloud of gas and dust in space, where new stars may form. The butterfly's two wings are giant bubbles of hot interstellar gas blowing from the hottest, most massive stars in this region. So it's a beautiful thing. So that's one of the great things about astronomy. You have all the theory and you can study astronomy. You can read a book about it, but then you can go out and even look at pictures in the book. But when you're, what's really rewarding, you get your telescope and you point it to the sky, and what you can see is so beautiful. So here it shows a giant butterfly. This is an infrared. It looks like a butterfly. I guess you can say it's a butterfly. And it's just a bunch of glowing gas, red or orange. And again, the article is March 27, 2019, www.nasa.gov. Space butterfly is home to hundreds of baby stars. So what looks like a red butterfly in space is reality a nursery. So a lot of stars are being born for hundreds of baby stars in a nebula called W40. Besides being beautiful, W40 exemplifies how the formation of stars results in the destruction of the very clouds that helped create them. Inside giant clouds of gas and dust in space, the force of gravity pulls material together into dense clumps. Sometimes these clumps reach a critical density that allows stars to form at their cores. So remember, I think it's the gas and the dust has to be cool in order to clump. If it's too hot, it's going too fast and it can't clump. When they're going slowly, particles can hit and clump easier. I believe that's the theory. So back to the article. Radiation and winds coming from the most massive stars in those clouds, combined with the material spewed out into space when those stars eventually explode, sometimes form bubbles like those in W40. So that's a beautiful photograph. But these processes also disperse the gas and dust, breaking up dense clumps and reducing or halting new star formation. So I'm going to click it to see. Yeah, it's a bigger photo, so it's quite beautiful. So, I guess it'd be great to work at one of those observatories or even one of those places where you can see this. So when I was in Hawaii, I went up to the Big Island and up the mountain, and there was a tour of one of the telescopes. And the tour ended at 4:30, so you could have went inside and toured it, and they would explain things probably. But then, of course, the best thing to do is get there at night, and you can look at it. But just being up in the mountain, with even without a telescope, was quite amazing because you can see the Milky Way. And again, I've seen the Milky Way in different places, and this wasn't the best view of the Milky Way I had because I think there was a half moon, or more than half a moon, so it lit up some of the sky. And it wasn't as dark as it could have been. So when I was in the desert in California, that's the best time I saw a beautiful Milky Way. So, so back to the article. The material that forms W40's wings was ejected from a dense cluster of stars that lies between the wings in the image. The hottest, most massive of these stars, W40 IRS1A, lies near the center of the star cluster. W40 is about 1,400 light years from the Sun, about the same distance as the well-known Orion Nebula, although the two are almost 180 degrees apart in the sky. These are two of the nearest regions in which massive stars with masses upwards of 10 times that of the Sun have been observed to be forming. I wonder how many stars are forming. They don't say that, but they say, a dense cloud of gas. So there's probably lots, but is it hundreds or thousands? I don't know. Another cluster of stars named Serpens South can be seen to the right upper wing of W40 in this image. Although both Serpens South and the cluster at the heart of W40 are young in astronomical terms, less than a few million years old, Serpens South is the younger of the two. Its stars are still embedded within their cloud, but will someday break out to produce bubbles like those of W40. Spitzer has also produced a more detailed image of the Serpens South cluster. So I'm opening that to see what the detail. Yeah, beautiful. Wow, you should look at that. So again, go to this article if you're interested. It's called Space Butterfly is Home to Hundreds of Baby Stars on NASA.gov, dated March 27, 2019. And down there it says, one, two, three, four. At the bottom of the fourth paragraph, it says, here's a more detailed image. And when you click it, it really is truly spectacular. Thousands and thousands of stars. It really is quite a beautiful image. So if you have a couple of seconds, go to that and you'll see beautiful stars with a lot of red gas lit up. So wonder what the red's from. I guess some super talented astronomer knows. A mosaic of Spitzer's observation of the W4D star forming region was originally published as part of the Massive Young Stellar Cluster Study in Infrared and X-Rays, Survey of Young Stellar Objects. So here again, you can go to this article, and again, I'll tell it, it's Space Butterflies Home to Hundreds of Baby Stars, March 27, 2019. And it again, you can click something, and it has a catalog of everything you've seen. And I opened it, but I'm not going to go further in it. Okay, so let's see. Spitzer is composed of four images. Oh, sorry. The Spitzer picture is composed of four images taken with the telescope's infrared array camera, IRAC. Infrared array camera, interesting. How does an infrared array camera work? During Spitzer's prime mission, in different wavelengths of infrared light, 3.6, 4.5, 5.8, and 8.0 micrometers, shown as blue, green, orange, and red. So 3.6 micrometers is blue, 4.5 micrometers is green, 5.8 micrometers is orange, and 8.0 micrometers is red. Organic molecules made up of carbon and hydrogen, called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs, are excited by interstellar radiation and become luminescent at wavelengths near 8 micron, given the nebula its reddish features. So the whole picture is kind of orangey red, a bright red, almost orangey maybe, but dark red. And it says here that organic molecules made of carbon and hydrogen, called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. I think they're called aromatic not because they're aromatic and smell good. It's a different technical term. PAHs are excited by interstellar radiation and become luminescent at wavelengths near 8 microns, giving the nebula its reddest features. Stars are brighter at the shorter wavelengths, giving them a blue tint. Stars are brighter at the shorter wavelengths, giving them a blue tint. Some of the youngest stars are surrounded by dusty disks of material, which glow with a yellow or red hue. The Jet Propulsion Laboratory manages the Spitzer Space Telescope for NASA Science Mission Directed in Washington. So question I have here is, sometimes I watch these shows and they show, look at these brilliant photos. So they show star system or nebula or some galaxy, and it looks quite amazing. But what happens is, sometimes if it's a visible telescope, they point their telescope at this thing and they accumulate the light over quite an amount of time. So it's not like you're looking at this bright image. What happens is your equipment will gather all the light over a long period of time, and then the image that produced, it comes from that, from pointing it at a long period of time. And I don't know if these scientists are even, it looks like they don't even care about the images where I'm looking at and I say it's so beautiful, but they're looking at the data, they're monitoring their systems, they're seeing how things are progressing, they're testing their theories, they're looking at equations, doing all these things. So it's not like they're sitting there going, wow, look at this beautiful image. I don't even think they see sometimes the image, and they might glimpse at the image, but they're not enthralled with the image like someone like me. So I would look at this image and I would go, wow, that looks beautiful. And to these scientists, as I seen, they kind of sit there and look at their data and monitor the whole process and aren't really so enamored with the image like someone like me would be. So anyway, so that's a beautiful picture from the Spitzer Space Telescope. Okay, so let's wrap up by going forward to the moon, exploring the moon to Mars. So there's a webpage here on NASA.gov, and it says, President Donald Trump has asked NASA to accelerate our plans to return to the moon and to land humans on the surface again by 2024. We will go with innovative new technologies and systems to explore more locations across the surface than was ever thought possible. This time when we go to the moon, we will stay, and then we will use what we learn on the moon to take the next giant leap, sending astronauts to Mars, end quote. So this is NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine. So that'll be interesting how they, I hope they can think about learning to live off the moon, not like, as I said, Sir John Franklin went to the Arctic with supplies, hoping to live off the supplies, and when the supplies expired, or as I said, maybe some of the tin cans that his supplies were in, at colder temperatures, the packing of the molecules or the atoms changed their structure, and I think some of the tin cans fall apart. And like Napoleon's armies on the battlefield, when it got cold, the buttons fell off the jackets of the soldiers. So these things impacted his journey. So it looks like here they're going to, this time when we go to the moon, we will stay. So they will have to learn to live off the moon. And that's, I think, that is their probably one of their prime goals, is because when they go to Mars for a six mission, they can't pack 6 months of supplies. And then when they get to if they ever land on Mars, it's not like someone on Mars will say, okay, so like it's not like your mom will make you a lunch and say, here, this is your food on the way back home. They have to live off what they grow in space. They have to maybe dock with asteroids to get fuel or water. When they're on Mars, they'll have to live on Mars for a while and then come back. So this all is, looks like a learning process where they'll do this, and they hopefully will gain all this knowledge to go into outer space. So again, we're in our infancy in doing this. I hope we get to do this quickly because it'll be very interesting, and we are destined to go in the outer solar system, because you know what? We are a space-faring race. There's no doubt about that. We've been to, we even left our two Voyagers in this article, or in this, in the show, I talked about the Voyagers. They've left interstellar space. We've had missions to, I think, all the planets, to different asteroids. There's the OSIRIS-REx mission. It's circling the Bennu asteroid, going to bring back samples from that asteroid. There's all kinds of other missions planned. We're on Mars. We've been there for a long time. And now it says exploring the moon to Mars, forward to the moon. So our race is a space-faring race. There is no doubt about that, because we have been into outer space. People have walked on the moon. And there's going to be the next step. How far are we going to go? So this is my passion. This is astronomy. It is a very interesting topic, at least if you ask me. This is my hobby. I've been doing it for a long time. So maybe it'll pay off in big ways when we, in the future, when human beings go into outer space. So will a woman walk on the moon within 5 years? That'll be an interesting thing to think about. So Wouldn't that be cool if a woman walked on the moon? Now, that would be interesting. So thank you for listening. This is Marco. You have listened to another edition of Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
Where did we come from? How did the universe come into being? Are we alone in the universe? All my life, I have sought to understand the universe.
Yeah. Bad boy, baby. Loon.
Yeah, come on.
Here on Astrotalk. You're listening to Astrotalk, CITR's weekly astronomy talk show with your host, Marco.